The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead. The Big Lead. Top National.
David goes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. And The Big Lead today sounds an awful lot like The Big Lead yesterday. The Big Lead yesterday was the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case. But while that verdict was being read, a number of media outlets, including the New York Times and major television cable outlets, were announcing the shooting death of Makiya Bryant. She is the young girl, 16 years old, from Columbus, Ohio, who was shot by police. And again, it was presented in such a way as to show, you know, here there's more violence against police. Yet another example of police violence. And of course, it depends on how you define violence. But the incident...
Looks like we might have lost Dave again. Hang on a second. Take a couple spots here. Be right back.
Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. Dory is on vacation. I know, I don't allow it to happen very often. I didn't want you to forget about us. So here's a little best of in the middle of a little Dave Bowes. Here's Dory with Brent Bozell.
It is a subject we have discussed many, many times, and that is, in my view, Donald Trump has a lot of things that are worth goofing on, but there are a lot of things that I care about in the president, the economy, national security, where I think he has done and is doing a terrific job, and that never seems to get reported in the mainstream media. There is a book about that very topic that I'm enjoying very much. It's called Unmasked, Big Media's War Against Trump, and Brent Bozell from the Media Research Center, he is with us to discuss it. Brent, it's good to talk to you this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me.
It sounds like your approach to Trump was very similar to mine. I knew I could never vote for Hillary. I have a wife and three daughters. And the day that Access Hollywood tape came out, I said, you know, I can't vote for this guy. Because I also thought that the downside risk was pretty great. I had no idea if he was, you know, going to be totally crazy or not. And so I ended up not voting for him. But as I said, I think he's doing a pretty good job on the things I care about, the economy and national security. Sounds like you approached him from kind of that same skeptical eye at first.
Sure. I mean, when he invited me to visit with him to discuss his campaign, which we bring out in our book, I was, as I wrote, I was prepared not to like him. I just didn't like the public persona that we'd known for years, you know, braggadocious, pompous, arrogant, all those things. But the extraordinary thing was that when you spent an hour alone with him, you visited with somebody who was completely different. He was quiet. He was probing. He was solicitous. He was engaging. He was warm. He was courteous. All the things I didn't expect.
You know, so funny as I was reading you say that, because I've had two experiences with him. He was in the studio with me for an hour about, I don't know, 15, 17 years ago. Same thing. I was expecting the biggest ass in the world. No phone, no entourage, asked about my family during breaks, remembered what he had asked and followed up during the next commercial break. I was charmed by the guy. And it seems like, I mean, that is a pretty unique skill that obviously has served him very, very well.
Yeah, I explained that charm or charisma. I mean, that cuts both ways. I mean, charisma is the crowds that were shouting for John Paul to be canonized a saint the moment he died. But then you have Vladimir the Impaler, who shish kebab 16,000 Turkish soldiers into the ground. I guess he has some charisma too. But Trump, you know, the problem I had with Trump was I was a Cruz supporter. He knew I was a Cruz supporter when we had lunch together, and he asked me if he thought he should run And I love it. Everybody says, well, I knew he was going to win. I told him to his face there was no way he could. But I told him he should run anyway because he had to scratch an itch that he'd had for several years. He had to also get his skeletons out, about which we could assume he had many. And then I hoped that President Cruz would name him to hold up to head up a commission to fix the federal government, because I wanted to watch him fire several hundred thousand people.
Yeah.
Because nobody can fire people like Donald Trump.
Right.
But then, you know, the campaign started and the old Trump came out, and things that I found very disagreeable. At the end, you know, Hillary won, and my position obviously had to change, and it did. Although, you know, with the MRC, I stayed neutral, because you have to, but with my other organization, For America, I was anything but neutral. Since the election, I think conservatives, virtually all, maybe not all, but virtually all conservatives, have to admit that even if you supported him from the beginning, you didn't expect him to be this conservative and have this level of commitment. You just didn't.
Right.
There's just no way you could have predicted it.
Well, and there was a lot of pressure. You are considered one of the standard bearers of the right in this country. And I know that there was a lot of pressure on people like you to be one of those never Trumpers. And because of that unknown X factor in him, there were people who were afraid that he was going to go back to the Democrat that he was 20 years ago.
You know, there was that now infamous National Review magazine that was devoted entirely to a critique of him. I was asked to submit one of the pieces, and I did. And I don't apologize for it one bit, because it was true. It explained why I wasn't supporting him and why I was supporting Cruz, which was asking the question, does he walk with us? And pointing out how Ronald Reagan walked with conservatives. He wrote pieces for conservatives. He raised money for conservatives. He ran as a conservative. He was on television as a conservative. He did whatever he could to help conservative causes long before he ran for president. So he was one of us. Donald Trump, up until the moment he decided to run, was a Hillary Clinton supporter. He was a Planned Parenthood supporter. He was a liberal Democratic supporter. So he didn't walk with us. Now, that was an issue that was entitled Not Trump. That issue became the Bible for the never Trump movement. I was
right.
Never a never Trump person. And that magazine was not that magazine. That specific magazine issue was not supposed to be a never Trump declaration. The problem was that a whole lot of the editors, maybe not the entire editorial direction, but most editors of National Review became never Trumpers.
Right.
And so anyone who wrote a piece with that got associated with the never Trump movement, you know, by default. I never was, but that's where it was.
Well, and we're talking with L. Brent Bozell. His new book is Unmasked, Big Media's War Against Trump. So, you know, as I explained, I didn't vote for him for, you know, a specific reason, but I remained open-minded, and I have mostly liked what I've seen, except for the adding $3 trillion to the nation's debt,
right,
which I despise. Right. But I've remained open-minded. It is amazing to me, Brent, how CNN in particular, MSNBC, it's not that shocking, but they have been willing to destroy themselves because of their abject hatred for this man, and it's amazing to watch, Brent.
Yeah, Dorian, it's very true. We write in this book that this is a story about a media that tried to destroy Donald Trump and destroyed themselves instead. I believe, you know, people ask me why the hatred of why is this so extraordinary that you have the greatest hostility toward a president and his administration in the history of the republic. I mean, you look at the numbers every month: 89%, 92%, 91%, 94% negative news coverage, and he has got a slew of successes a mile long, and they're just ignored with nothing but negative news. Why? Why this hostility? And the answer is that it's a perfect storm of three different issues. One, Donald Trump was a threat to the transformational revolution of Barack Obama, which was going to be solidified by Hillary Clinton. And he could, in fact, undo so much, and he absolutely has undone so much of the Obama revolution. That was one. Number two was that they hate him personally. He was their creation. He was Hollywood's creation. Mm-hmm. And they realized they created a monster. That's how they saw it. They ridiculed him when he first ran because they thought he was not just a gadfly, but he was someone they could hang around the neck of the Republican Party. And as he got stronger and stronger, they look with increasing horror at this monster they've created in their eyes. And so they set to do everything in their power to prevent him from getting the presidency. And ever since then, to remove him from the presidency, which, by the way, also shows an abject dismissal of the American voter, where they would undo the will of the American people. But then the third issue was that Donald Trump declared war on him, on them. You know, it is true that Richard Nixon despised the media. It's true that the media and Ronald Reagan did not have great love for each other, but neither Nixon nor Reagan nor anyone ever made it such a frontal assault, and in fact made it issue number one, repeated every single day by Trump. So you put those three things together, and it's the perfect storm. They would destroy themselves. I think they have with their credibility. I don't think CNN ever regains it. I don't think MSNBC ever regains it, if for whatever they had that was left. Networks like that, some of the newspapers, they'll never regain the credibility because people will see them as being so left-wing and having picked sides, yeah, ideologically, which ruins their credibility.
Yeah. How do you think this ends? Does he get a second term?
Well, how does this end? What that worldview is the long-term worldview. Short-term, it remains to be seen what exactly will have happened by Election Day. Here are two scenarios. One, the media will have done enough damage already and will be able to do enough damage between now and the election to cause him two or three ticks in the poll. That's enough. Those two or three percentage points in a close race is enough to deliver the presidency to the other side. The other flip of the coin shows that the media could so embolden his base to work for him and to vote for him that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They could go out and they could cause Donald Trump an additional 2 or 3 percentage points and give him the victory. Either way, I believe, Dory, that the media will be the decisive factor in the 2020 campaign.
Yep, I think you're right as well. Well, it's a really terrific book, Unmasked, Big Media's War Against Trump. L. Brent Bozell and Tim Graham wrote it. Brent, great talk with you. Love having you on the show, and I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, and I'd love to hear what you think about all this. The Online Trading Academy text line is 98973. That's 98973, and we have lots more straight ahead. You're on the Dory Monson Show.
All right, welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. David Bowes filling in for Dory Monson for real this time. It's good to be here. I did a hell of a show. Nobody heard it. But that's the way things go sometimes, especially in the COVID era. Hannah Scott's going to join us now. The King County seeks to ban facial recognition software, and the legislature is doing some work on trying to make it easier to get rid of bad police officers. Hannah, how you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So let's start with what the legislature's up to. Okay. How is the legislature dealing with bad police officers?
You know, they spent a lot of the time, as soon as the death of George Floyd happened a year ago, almost, they were a group of lawmakers that started meeting right away. And at one point, I think in the interim, there was more than 60 bills that were maybe going to be introduced. Obviously, that was a big ask, especially with the remote session mostly. So they kind of whittled that down to almost a couple dozen. And now, as we near the end of session, several of those have passed. You saw ones that are heading to the governor is the independent investigation office that's being created. Now, this didn't turn out quite as many had hoped for. You'll see some law enforcement or former law enforcement that are allowed to be hired on as investigators for that, which is something some family members of those killed by police didn't want. But they tell me that they're on board with that because there's a sunset. I believe it's 5 years. Within 5 years, they have to go to an all-civilian investigative force. But out of the gate, they want to make sure there's some kind of person who has some sort of history investigating things. So that one is passed, and that's a big one when it comes to rebuilding trust with community. Here in just the last couple of days, we've seen the passage of the decertification bill. That's from Senator Peterson, which is basically the teeth, as he explained it to me, in the accountability efforts in the legislature. It would lay out this path. They already have this decertification process, but it's very rarely used. And that's basically like, you know, if a lawyer is disbarred or a nurse loses their license, it's that kind of thing. They lose the right to be a cop in the state of Washington. And it's not used very often. So they add to the commission that looks into investigating these things. I believe it's up to a 21-person commission now, and they added a few more law enforcement parts to that commission, but it's still going to be civilian majority, which is another big, big thing families wanted in order to rebuild some of that trust with community. And then just today, we had the tactics bill that's going to ban chokeholds, neck restraints, no-knock warrants, and a couple of other things that came out of conference committee. So that'll have to come up for one final vote, as well as the basically definitions of use of force. There's what exactly cops are supposed to do and not supposed to do when it comes to using force, when they should use deadly force, that kind of thing, new rules for that, and a duty to intervene bill that came out as well, which, as we saw with George Floyd, it would have kind of required those three other officers to do something when they saw that level of force instead of just standing there.
So, question on that. I mean, there's a number of things there, but one that you brought up was this the civilian board of investigation. What was the reasoning behind? I take it. How do you get experience in investigation? And how are the civilians selected for this investigative committee?
And this is all done by
the police aren't allowed on it. And former
police. Well, no, but they are. There will be cops on it. So that's the whole thing. That's what was just.
I mean, after 5 years.
Well, so then they'll be trained up. Presumably through some of the exact rules will be laid out by the Criminal Justice Training Commission moving forward. But the idea is, I believe, that after 5 years, you'll have kind of these civilians who've spent 5 years doing this and know what they're doing when it comes to these kind of investigations, or can hire. I mean, it's a mix of people too. I believe you've got some prosecutors and different representatives on the 21 member commission, but it was said on the floor that if after 5 years, we're not at the place where we can have a completely civilian investigation team, then we will, you know, we can expand that to 10 years, because I believe Republicans tried to add it to 10 years on the floor and it didn't pass. But there's that opening if they need it, they said.
It's kind of a strange thing, too, because, you know, police are civilians. They're supposed to reflect the community they serve. And I think police now represent that probably in a greater way than ever before. So it's pardon me?
You mean, yes. With diversity? And I think you're right about that, but there's the one overarching thing that I know that I hear from every family member of someone who's lost someone at the hands of police is that they do not trust cops to investigate other cops. So that's why that big push to have the civilian and the community members who are on that. They did not, however, get the bill passed that would have created these community oversight boards for all local police agencies, like we see kind of in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So When it comes to decertification, when would that kick in? I mean, would it be after a single complaint? Would this these commissions, would they look at, you know, all complaints, or do they look at it at a certain point?
So all complaints would automatically go there. All deadly use of force incidents would automatically go to them, and they would look into that. And that, and then there's they created kind of this graduated tiered system for misconduct also. So right now, the way that the decertification system works, it's just there's the one thing. If you're found to have used deadly use of force incorrectly, you get decertified. Or I think if you lie or a certain a couple of things. Now you'll have kind of some lower misconduct standards that serve as sort of a point system. So if you get caught for this one level of misconduct, it'll kind of tally up like your driver's license points, if you will. And if it gets to a certain point, they can go ahead and start this investigation. There was, I believe, language in that said they would suspend you immediately when they start an investigation. That was just stripped out, I believe, today in conference, so that you would have to have some sort of due process, right? You can't just have an accusation against a cop of misconduct of some sort and then, you know, take them and suspend them immediately. You have to wait. And that's for that lower level of misconduct. Obviously, if it's deadly use of force, they're automatically, you know, off on administrative leave.
Right, right. They'd be on. And have police groups signed off on these changes, or what's the status on that?
There's it's a mixed bag, definitely a mixed bag. I think across the board on all of these bills that have passed, you'll see Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chief with some particular issues. I mean, they all had some support for some of the things in these bills. There's a lot going on in most of them. For instance, the decertification bill, I believe at last check, all the police groups were not quite on board with that, although they did get, as I said, the extra law enforcement membership on that commission, which they were excited about and was one of the big sticking issues. The big concern there is that you're giving too much power to what had been a training agency and now is becoming a regulatory agency. So that's kind of the pushback there. But the Washington Fraternal Order of Police supported many of these bills, including the tactics bill, which bans the neck restraints, the choke holds, and the no-knock warrants and things like that.
Okay, before we run out of time, I want to swing over to the King County effort to ban facial recognition technology when it comes to government use, not private business use, but government use. So what's the reasoning behind the effort?
This is, as you've seen, if you've seen the national conversation coming from the ACLU, that it's disproportionately affecting people of color, specifically black people who have been misidentified by some of this technology. In fact, I was just talking earlier today about a case that I believe was filed a couple of weeks ago from a black man in a 2018 case who was arrested and detained for 30 hours as somebody who was busted for a shoplifting. Like, he was in his vehicle on the freeway. I think this was in Detroit, and the technology misidentified him somehow. And so now he's suing. And I believe that's the third lawsuit to come from this kind of technology. So everything being done in our state right now is being done through the racial equality lens. And that's what you heard from Jeanne Cole Wells, who proposed this ban yesterday. And I think they'll vote on it maybe in a couple of weeks for the first time. But you heard from people who the ACLU came out and said, you know, this has a terrible impact, the misidentification, and it can affect everything from people of color to people who identify their gender as identification issues, that kind of thing. So they just feel that it's too much of an overreach. But I think you're seeing catch up, right? People don't understand the technology, and various jurisdictions are trying to get some kind of regulation out there.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading the story on it, and I thought that, what I wondered is, aren't there misidentifications in all kinds of other ways as well? So a misidentification by itself isn't necessarily an argument to stop using it. And I wondered, what are the ways that it's being used that are actually effective and helpful for government? And at the same time, I can understand privacy concerns where people don't want to be tracked everywhere they go on every street corner. So, it seems
definitely
like there
heard
might
that.
Be some,
Yeah.
So it might be some ways to save the good and ditch the bad, particularly since, you know, efforts to ban technology rarely work. I mean, just somebody else has to use it.
That ship may have sailed, right. So, and I want to be clear, this is like King County trying to ban county agencies from using it. So the sheriff's department, right, which does not use it right now, that kind of thing. But you did hear what you're talking about. Cairo 7 TV talked to a security association person who said, look, this is used to find missing children who are being, in the human trafficking scene and things like that, or silver alerts for your missing seniors that they've been able to successfully do things. I think he said they've successfully saved thousands of people in the last few years, kids involved in human trafficking with this technology. So possibly more conversation to be had there for sure. I know there was a federal study, though, that confirmed the racial bias of many facial recognition systems. That's why you started to see this conversation come up, and then the individual cases that we're seeing as well.
Okay. Well, Hannah, appreciate the work, and thanks for coming on the Dory Monson Show.
Always a pleasure. Good talking to you, Dave.
Thanks. David Bowes filling in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David goes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. It looks like Manhattan is going to stop prosecuting prostitution as part of a national trend, a national shift. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office announced it would no longer prosecute prostitution and unlicensed massage. That's kind of a strange euphemism, isn't it? I mean, the unlicensed massage part, are they really prosecuting that, or is that like a ticket you get for delivering a great massage, or is there something else there? Maybe they could just lift the licensing requirements for massage rather than to conflate the two. I remember a long time ago, my girlfriend at the time was a massage therapist, and there's one thing massage therapists do not like. It's the reputation or the euphemisms of like unlicensed massage and the connotations that has, because of, well, I mean, it's kind of like, the scandal involving former Vice President Gore in Oregon, where he was reportedly requesting a release the chakra moment, and it's not appreciated by actual licensed massage therapists. But, here, if the question is not having the license, why not just lift the requirement, so that people can make that practice? But it's a strange thing. I mean, there's a lot of effort to try and get rid of a lot of crime. And in this case, they say that prosecuting prostitution has been way down for the last several years anyway, except during the Super Bowl. Also a strange thing. It's like, it's way down except when it was happening, on a regular basis in this area. So in this decision, they're going to keep prosecuting the Johns, but not prosecute the prostitutes. I suppose this is fair play, because for many years it was the prostitutes that got prosecuted and the Johns that got off with the, we'll see you later. You're lucky you're not under arrest kind of thing. And so now it's kind of like, all right, we gave them a break for too many years. Now we're going to uphold the law differently by gender here. And we're on which side of this crime is being violated, rather than uphold it equally. I just feel like if we don't like the law, change the law, right? If we're not going to uphold it, get rid of it. Since when can we just decide, there's a duly passed law, we no longer like to uphold it, so we're not going to prosecute it. That seems beyond prosecutorial discretion, and it's just a wholesale category of law that they're not really enthusiastic about. So why not have the legislature get rid of it? Unless you just want to use it so that you can hold something over somebody at some point if you don't like them, So, again, it's the kind of thing where at first glance you're like, okay, that makes sense. Or you could have, some kind of record expunged thing if that's what you want to do. But it doesn't make sense to me to just have this constant arbitrary, we're just going to not prosecute these laws, or we're not going to uphold these laws, and we're going to uphold the law on half of the party that's involved and not the other half, Just get rid of them if that's your goal, or treat people equally. It's getting to be absurd at this point. And I'll remind you that it might seem like a good idea to get rid of some of these laws, but I keep thinking back to New York and the general era of the 70s, and how you know, crime had risen to an out of control level, and people felt powerless in their own cities and streets. And there's a part of me that looks around and I feel like we're seeing, you know, kind of the rise of that same thing. Like the pendulum is swinging too far in one in the opposite direction. And so we've been riding on the coattails of the past. And now that we're making a bunch of changes, we could be swinging back the other direction. And that'll be a whole lot less pleasant. Coming up, we'll talk about what we missed in the big lead, which is the shooting of Micaiah Bryant, the 16-year-old young woman who was shot with a knife in her hand. And that's being described as police violence. But is it really? We'll talk about that next on the Dory Monson Show. David Bowes.